Now, still to come on today's show, we'll be learning a bit more about Charles Darwin, as I had the fantastic opportunity to look through some of the letters that he sent and see, in his very own words, the theory of evolution forming.
But before that, we're looking at evolution on a lab bench. Professor Richard Lenski works at Michigan State University, and in his lab, he's grown over 40,000 generations of E. coli for over 20 years. He's persuaded the bacteria to evolve totally new characteristics, giving scientists new insights in how organisms adapt and change over time.
Well, I've always been interested in the tension between evolution being a random process at the level of mutations, and yet natural selection provides a force that moves populations to become ever more adapted. And so this experiment with E. coli has been designed to look at how reproducible evolution really would be if we could repeat it. And so I created 12 lines of E. coli, all started from the same ancestral cell. And we've been propagating them in my lab for about 20 years now, and the bacteria have gone through 40,000 generations, and we're watching how they change and evolve.
What are the advantages of using a bacteria like E. coli to observe evolution in the lab?
One of the advantages of bacteria, of course, is that they have such short generations. Also, they have very large population sizes, so in a little flask in a corner of the lab, we can have millions of cells. And what's really cool to me is that we can freeze the bacteria away. And that allows us to directly compare ancestral and evolved organisms. And we're actually comparing the living organisms. It's not just fossils. It's the real live bacteria. So imagine a little bit like if we could bring Neanderthal back to life. We might try to play a game of football with the Neanderthals, and we could see how the organisms in their performance, not just in their fossil morphology, but in their real performance, have changed over time.
So what evolutionary changes have you seen since your very first cell line?
Well, one of the most important changes is that the evolved bacteria are demonstrably much more fit in this environment. So they actually grow close to twice as fast as did the ancestor. So when you compete them, the evolved bacteria kick butt. The evolved cells are much larger. And we're looking at how they've changed in many, many other properties. But in particular, the last few years, we've been looking at how they've changed in their genotype. So we're actually sequencing their DNA and finding the mutations that are responsible for their adaptation.
Recently, you reported on a rather more dramatic change that had happened, in that they seem to be able to use a different source of food. What had happened here?
In this medium that we've been feeding them every day for these last 20 years, they've been growing on glucose as the only source of energy that they can use that's in that environment. But throughout this entire experiment, we've had another carbon source that's been present in the medium, and it's called citrate. And one of the features that's been recognized of E. coli cells is that they're not able to use citrate as an energy source. It can't get inside the cell.
So this is one of the defining features that makes them an E. coli bacteria rather than something else?
It is, pretty much. There are little gray areas around the edge that are rather technical, but it's certainly the general property of E. coli, one of the defining characteristics by virtually all assays. And so for 20 years, they've been eating their glucose and not recognizing that there's an open niche, another resource available in their environment. But one of the 12 populations suddenly woke up, as it were, in an evolutionary sense, and said, there's something else to eat. There's a dessert tray around the corner after we finish our glucose. And so that population evolved the capacity to use this new carbon source as an energy source. And what we've done has been to try to ask, could any of the populations have evolved that new trait at any point in the experiment? So we've been trying to ask whether the genetic context changed so that this new phenotype became possible by virtue of the more or less inconsequential differences that it accumulated in one population versus the other 11 populations. And we took advantage of the fact that we have all these time points frozen away in our freezer. And with an extraordinarily dedicated graduate student, Zachary Blount, he essentially went back into the freezer and started the evolution experiments over from different time points along the way to the evolution of this interesting new trait. And what he found was that only after a certain point in time did he ever find mutants that were able to use citrate as a carbon source. So a sort of a historical accident of the genetic changes in one line versus the other lines had opened up this door that there was another possible way of making a living in this extremely simple laboratory environment.
So you need a series of smaller, seemingly irrelevant mutations in order to have this big mutation that lets you change your food source.
Yes, it's very clearly established that there were many mutations in these lines and that some subset of them that occurred in this population set up the potential to then get additional mutations that gave this very interesting new trait or phenotype. And in this simple little experiment that we've been doing in my lab, this one population out of the 12 we've been studying took a different road, got on a different evolutionary path, and that influenced its subsequent potential.
That was Professor Richard Lenski, who's been watching his E. coli evolve in the lab. His work shows that although evolution is often predictable, sometimes all of the little random mutations, which on their own don't amount to much, can allow some big dramatic changes, possibly even leading to the birth of a new species.
The Naked Scientist Podcast, brought to you by thenakedscientist.com.